So I was getting ready for the sermon this week. I ran across a meme on the internet. If you know what memes are, they're kind of funny pictures and put words with them and stuff. So I want to put the meme up for us to look at. So it's this person who's losing at Monopoly, and they're upset, and they're, you know, angry about it. And they say, well, what would Jesus do in this situation? And so then the picture of Jesus turning the table over, right? So I don't know about you, if you've ever been upset at a board game like Monopoly, but you just want to flip the table over, right? And so that's kind of the image that we have of Jesus in the temple. So I love board games. I've always loved board games since I was a little kid. We played them together as a family. On like evening nights, we'd get together and we'd play. And then especially as I got older into like high school, I started liking strategy board games. And one of my favorites back in the day was Risk. Anybody ever played the game Risk? Yeah, the game of global domination, right? And so the idea of Risk is that there's the whole world in front of you, and you have armies in different parts of the world, and then other people have armies other places. And you have to try to take over the whole world and defeat all the other armies so that you dominate the whole globe, right? But it's called Risk because you have to take risks in the game. So you have your armies here in one place, and to branch out and go somewhere else, there's a risk involved. You might lose, or you might spread yourself too thin, and somebody else could come and attack you from another front. But if you stay back too much, then their armies are going to get too big and you're going to get overwhelmed, right? So you have to make decisions. You have to have strategy about what to do. There are times when you trade in cards and you gain extra armies. And so there's some strategy involved about when to do that. And there's risk involved in all these decisions that you make. So risk is our theme for the season of Lent. We're using A.J. Levine's book, Entering the Passion of Jesus. And each week we'll talk about a different moment of Jesus' last week of life. And we'll identify a particular risk that is made during that moment. And so today we turn to this episode in which Jesus is in the temple and he turns the tables over. And so what risk is involved in that? Now, when I think of this story, kind of the image in my mind, and I imagine in many of our minds, is that Jesus comes into the temple kind of like a church, kind of like the sanctuary here, right? And that there's worship going on, the priests are up here, and they're making sacrifices, and people are singing and doing all this stuff. But in the back are these tables where people are selling things, and they're changing and lending money and all this kind of stuff. And so Jesus walks in and sees this place that should be a place of worship, and there's commerce going on in the back, and he gets upset. And he's so angry that he flips the tables over and he runs everybody out. And kind of the idea, the thought, is that because he does that, everything changes, right? Worship stops. Everybody's in shock that this has happened. And then they're convicted of the wrong that they've done, that they shouldn't be doing these things in the temple. And so it changes the culture, right? That's the idea in my mind from this story. Amy Jill Levine says, no, that's not how this worked at all, right? So the temple is not a single little building like this. She says that it's a huge complex, 12 soccer fields big is what she says, right? So here's a picture of a drawing of the ancient temple in Jerusalem. And so there were different areas in the temple. There was the Holy of Holies, which was kind of like the inner sanctum, the innermost part of the temple. And it was behind a curtain inside a building, and behind the curtain was an altar. And once a year, on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies and make a sacrifice for himself and for the whole nation of Israel. Now, beyond that was the court of the priests. And so this is where the priests, the Levitical priests, would be, and that's where they would make their sacrifices and do all the kind of ritual things that were involved in the temple. Beyond that was the court of Israel. And so the men who were Israelites, the Hebrew men, were allowed in this area. Outside of that was the court of women. And so women who were Israelites or Hebrew people could be in that area. And then beyond that was the court of the Gentiles, the court of the nations. And everyone was welcome in that place. And so if you look at the picture there, that's kind of the big courtyard beyond that, right? Kind of the biggest space that you see. And it was in that space where these commercial activities would be happening. And so we begin to think of the temple not just as a place of worship, not just a sanctuary, but it was almost like a tourist destination, right? People would come from miles around, from all over, to the temple, especially on these pilgrimage holidays, but at other times as well. And it was a sight to see. It was a thing to behold. And this is where kind of life gathered in Jerusalem. And then when people would come to make sacrifices, well, if they were coming from a far distance, they couldn't really bring their animals with them to sacrifice. I mean, they could try, but it would be a hardship. And what if the animal got sick or got hurt or even died on the way? What would they do? They'd be left without anything. And so it was important that animals would be for sale there, so that people who traveled a long distance could purchase the animal for the sacrifice that needed to be made. Another thing that would happen there is that people would change their money. So the temple itself wanted offerings of money to continue its work, but it had to be the shekel, the particular currency of that place. And so if you were coming from somewhere else that had a different currency, well, you needed to change your money. Just like if you go to a foreign country now, you need to change your dollars into euros or whatever it might be, right? And so that had to happen at the temple as well. And so these things were actually kind of essential for the work that the temple was to do. It was important for all that was going on there. And so it's almost like a big farmer's market. Y'all been to the farmer's market before, right? Where there's booths all over the place and it's spread out over a huge area. And so the image is not so much that Jesus does this and everything stops and everybody changes. But think about if you're at a farmer's market and one booth, there's a little thing, something happens, right? There's this little kerfuffle. Well, people on the other end of the farmer's market, they're going to have no idea that anything happened there, right? The few booths around it, they might kind of notice and then just kind of go back to their work, right? A.J. Levine says that's probably what happened when Jesus turned these tables over. There was a small little commotion there and you know, the area around it, people would have noticed and stuff, but then everybody just kind of went back to business as usual. And when we look even more closely at the text, it's not this action of turning over tables and things that gets Jesus into trouble. It's his teaching. He begins to teach after this, and it says that that's what bothers the religious authorities, his teaching. Not his turning over the tables, but his teaching and how the people respond and react to it. And so, rather than focusing on these acts of turning over the tables and all this stuff, what if we look at the teaching that Jesus does in the story? So the first thing that Jesus teaches, and he's quoting from the book of Isaiah here, is that the temple should be a house of prayer for all the nations. Let's put that verse up there, Deanna. So this is from Isaiah. It says, "And the foreigners who join themselves to the land, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it, and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the peoples." So that word there, peoples, nations sometimes, is the word in Greek that Jesus says is ethnos. Which our word ethnicity comes from, right? So when we hear nation, I think about a country, right? But in those days, a nation really was more a people group, often a race, which sometimes were identified with a particular nation or country, but not always. And so really, it's not as much a political statement as it is a statement about all of humanity being welcome at this place for worship. Wherever you come from, whatever your background is, whatever nation or race you are part of, the temple is a place where you can come and worship, a place where you can pray, a place where you can make an offering, a place where you can seek God and offer yourself to God. Now, of course, as I outlined, there's kind of different layers around all that. Different people were allowed in different places, and so we might raise some questions and issues around that, and especially from our modern day kind of reading. But the sentiment is there that all people, whoever you are invited to come to the temple and to worship. This idea of inclusion is important to us as a people of God. But there is some risk involved in inclusion, isn't there? You know, it's kind of easy if everybody is like you to get along with them, right? If people look like you, if they act like you, have the same kind of background, speak the same language, all those things, it's much easier to get along. But when there's difference, it inevitably creates conflict. And within conflict is potential, right? There's potential for negative things to happen, and there's potential for really positive and wonderful things to happen. I think I've got another quote to put up there, Deanna. Yeah, conflict contains the potential for both great harm and great good. When we encounter difference and conflict happens, sometimes we go and harm one another. We're scared of this difference. We're upset by this difference. We feel threatened by this difference. Maybe we even feel ashamed because of the difference. And so we lash out and we hurt other people because of the difference that is there. But I think the better path is to notice this difference, to talk about it, to even celebrate it, and to allow it to bring creativity and new possibilities to the forefront, to allow great good to happen. I think of all the great movements that have ever happened in the world, they're born out of conflict, aren't they? They're born out of conflict, and sometimes that conflict can lead to great and wonderful and beautiful things. But there's a risk, right? There's a risk, because sometimes it leads to great harm, but sometimes it can lead to wonderful and beautiful and good things. And I think part of the challenge here is that we are invited into that risk, to embrace the idea of inclusion, which might create conflict, knowing that it might lead down some difficult places, but it also might lead to something beautiful and wonderful and good, something that gives life and joy and new birth and peace. We, as a church, are committed to inclusion. We have a statement on the front of our bulletin that says that all are welcome to be part of our ministry. Whether you're male or female, rich or poor, black or white, whatever kind of distinctions you want to make, everyone is welcome here at Blakemore. And it creates conflict sometimes, doesn't it? But it also creates something beautiful and wonderful. It helps us to be in ministry to more people and to have new ideas that others might not have thought of and to do some wonderful and amazing things. And so part of what I might invite you to this week as part of Lent is to risk being around people who are different than you are. How will you risk being in relationship with someone who is different than you? Maybe you'll reach out to somebody that you see during your week that you don't know, that looks different than you do. Or maybe somebody that you do know that you don't know so well and that seems pretty different from you, you might invite to coffee or to lunch one day. There's risk involved, but I think there's great reward that's possible as well. After Jesus says that the temple should be a house of prayer for all nations, for all the people, he then says, but you've turned it into a den of thieves. I always took this to mean that the activities that were going on there, the selling the animals and the money changing, were somehow unjust practices, right? But A.J. Levine says, no, that's not the case at all. Again, that those things were essential and they were needed and necessary for the work of the temple. Again, people needed to buy animals to sacrifice. They needed to change their money so they could make offerings at the temple. And she says that the priests would not have let those practices become predatory in any kind of way, that they would have kept them just, right? And so it's not these practices that Jesus is talking about when he says that it's become a den of thieves. When you think about that phrase, den of thieves, the den of thieves is the place where the thieves go to be safe, right? So they've gone out in the world and they've done their nefarious activities, they've stolen, they've done all these things, and then they come back to their den to be safe. It's their safe spot. It's where they can collude with other thieves and make plans. It's where they can hide their money. It's where they can be safe. It's not the place where they're doing those activities. And so, her interpretation at least, is that that's what Jesus is saying about the temple. It's not the place where people are going to take advantage of others and to do unjust and predatory things, but it's become a safe place for the people who've done that. So bring it more into modern times. What if there were a church where the people who were part of the church went out into the world and they did all kinds of dishonest things in the world? They treated each other unkindly. They said words that were harsh and mean and hurtful. They stole. They cheated. They took advantage of other people. And then they came to church on Sunday mornings and everybody acted like everything was okay. That there was no problem at all with how they were living in the world. I think that's what Jesus is saying was happening at the temple. People were going out in the world and they were doing all these terrible things to other people, and then they were coming back to the temple and no one said anything at all. No one reminded them that the law demands that we treat others with justice and kindness. That we care for those who are on the margins. That we care for the widows, the orphans, and the immigrants. That we seek justice in the world. That we allow righteousness to be our guiding path. Jesus was saying when people came back to the temple, they weren't reminded of those things. And so I wonder if Blakemore has become like that in any kind of way. Have we become a place where we just gather and pretend like everything is okay and that it doesn't matter how we live in the world? So maybe part of the risk that we take during Lent is to examine our lives, not here in this place, how we treat one another here, but how we live in the world, how we operate at our jobs, how we respect our teachers, how we interact with our family and friends. May this place never be a den of thieves or robbers, but may we honestly look at ourselves and live the lives that God has called us to live. In the end, we see that Jesus is angry in this story, right? Jesus gets upset. And as Steffi talked about in the children's message, anger can be a really good thing. It tells us that there is something wrong. If you're angry about something, it means that something is wrong in the scenario. And sometimes we get angry because people have done things to us, or often it's just that we don't get our way, right? Reminded from the kids talking about their siblings, I would get angry at my sister when I was a kid. But it wasn't that she was really doing anything wrong or harmful. She just wasn't doing what I wanted her to do, right? Often that's how I find myself getting angry with other people. They're just not doing what I want them to do. They're not cooperating. They're not doing the things I think they should. And that kind of anger, it's more about me, right? It's more about kind of my own preferences and my own pride and my own want for control. But there's another kind of anger, the kind that we might call righteous anger or even holy anger. And it's anger when you look at a situation and you see that others are being harmed, that injustices are being perpetrated, that the world is not as it should be. And when we see those things, it should make us angry. When we see people who have to live on the streets because they don't have a home, we should be angry about that, because that's wrong. When we see people who don't have enough to eat, we should be angry. When we see young women who are sold into sex trafficking, we should be angry, because that's wrong. When we see people who are excluded from church because of any reason, we should be angry, because that's wrong. When we see unarmed black men shot by police officers for no reason, we should be angry, because that is wrong. Friends, our world is full of injustices, full of harm that is being done. And we should feel angry at all of those things. Sometimes I feel so angry that it's overwhelming, right? Because there's so much wrong in the world. And it's easy to have kind of a knee-jerk reaction, right? To want to turn the table over, right? And sometimes you need to do that. But I think most of the time, it's better to kind of sit with that anger. Figure out where it's coming from. Pray about it. Talk with other people about it. And come up with actions together. Not reactions that are immediate because of this feeling that you have, but a true response to what has been done. A measured and a thoughtful and a Holy Spirit-inspired response. And so the real invitation I have for us today is around this. In our musical reflection, I'll invite you to think about what it is that makes you angry in the world. What harm or injustice do you see? To sit with that as Matthew plays the piano, to pray about it, and then to commit yourself to talking about it with others, to continuing to pray about it, and then to offering some kind of response. To allow God to use this anger that is placed in you to make some kind of positive difference in the world. Now that's risky. It's risky to sit with that anger. It's risky to put yourself out there and try to make a difference. It's risky to talk to other people about the things that make you angry. But we are called to be people who risk. And so I think that if God's reign is truly to come, we as the people of God must risk having righteous anger.